You're listening to In the Thick of It, a podcast from the HCM Society, where we interview experts in the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy field to broaden the awareness of new HCM studies and advancements. In today's episode, host Dr. Patrizia Galaska welcomes our guest, Dr. Sarah Saberi. They discuss the intricacies of cardiac myosin inhibitors, addressing a common query: when to pull the trigger on cardiac myosin therapy in NYHA Class II HCM patients. Dr. Saberi is a renowned expert in the realm of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, serving as an assistant associate professor in the Division of Cardiovascular Medicine and co-director of the Inherited Cardiomyopathy Program at the Frankl Cardiovascular Center. Join us as we explore this vital topic together. Let's get in the thick of it. Here's Dr. Galaska and Dr. Saberi.
So, Sarah, to start off with our questions, our modern understanding of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy has grown exponentially over the last several decades. We know now that HCM is more common. It's genetically diverse. It's very heterogeneous disease. And now we also have these specific disease-specific pharmacotherapies. The initial approach to treatments before, or even now, we still continue to use beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, which are weak negative inotropes and which sometimes may be insufficient to control patients' symptoms. But since the first-in-class cardiac myosin inhibitor, mavacamten, was approved by the FDA in April of 2022, we now have more pharmacotherapies in our toolbox, as I said, which are more disease-specific. Could you tell us about how this novel myosin inhibitor therapy came about and how these drugs have been conceived?
Sure. It's really my pleasure to talk about it. It's one of the things that I think is really exemplifies what an amazing scientific journey we have been kind of walking in the last several decades. So really, it started with the realization that HCM was a disease of the sarcomere, the motor within the myocytes. And that realization came from the identification of variants of the genes that were encoding sarcomere proteins that then linked to actual disease that we could see. So identifying the genes really naturally led to understanding which proteins were involved. And it took a bit of mechanistic work after that to understand the ways in which the proteins behave differently, dependent on the type of genetic change involved, the specific protein involved. And let's just be really clear, that work is truly ongoing. But it's all of that work that identified that the basic insult to the sarcomere in this disease process is hypercontractility. And so once that was understood, it wasn't a stretch to ask the next question, well, how can we fix that? And that is really a gross overview of how myosin inhibitors came to be.
Wow. Thank you so much. This is such an inspiring story. It's wonderful to hear how we are now focusing on this hypercontractile state in obstructive or hypertrophic cardiomyopathy by reducing the sarcomere forces generation, by reducing this myocardial hypercontractility, and ultimately resulting in reduction of LVOT obstruction. So as you said, cardiac myosin inhibitors provide a promising addition to the therapeutic armamentarium that we have for obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and it's truly a paradigm shift that we've seen in this disease-specific pharmacotherapy. So going on to the next question, what in our trials, what benefit do cardiac myosin inhibitors provide in treatment of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or what specific positive endpoints did we see in the clinical trials compared to placebo?
Well, there's so many to talk about. So I guess we can start really with the trials of mavacamten, which have initially, it started with the largest trial being Explorer, which was a phase 3 clinical trial after the initial phase 2. And what it showed was that there was a significant improvement in the two things that we probably care about: feel and function. So feel was assessed by New York Heart Association class, and function was assessed by peak VO2 or cardiopulmonary respiratory fitness, and showed a significant improvement in both symptom burden and exercise or functional capacity. Concomitant with, of course, a significant reduction in outflow obstruction, improvements in cardiac structure that really point towards positive remodeling. So things like left atrial volume size, every measure of hypertrophy burden, be it wall thickness or myocardial mass, improvements in not just how we assess how patients feel, but really how they feel in their day-to-day in terms of health status, so assessed by KCCQ questionnaires and other questionnaires of symptom index, reductions in the severity of mitral regurgitation, reductions in diastolic dysfunction, and that has been replicated in longer-term data as assessed in the MAVA-LTE open label extension study. In the next in class, myosin inhibitor aficamten, we see similar findings. The Redwood cohorts 1 and 2 studies looking at two different doses of aficamten for treatment of obstructive HCM also showed dramatic reductions in the degree of outflow obstruction to go along with, you know, symptom improvement and markers of diastolic dysfunction. We don't have as much data on aficamten because really those the investigations of aficamten are much newer than Explorer, but they're certainly coming fast.
No, that's such an exciting time in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy to be in. And when you see a patient, thank you for sharing all of these points, important points. When you see a patient in your clinic with obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, who's a class 2 patient, what would be your ideal treatment cocktail, given that we do have these disease-specific medication at this point? When would you initiate a cardiac myosin inhibitor in this class 2 patient? And would you initiate it alone? Would you initiate it in sort of conjunction with other therapies such as beta blockers or calcium channel blockers? And why?
Yeah. So I will answer this question and say that what I do is not probably universal and that many people will do things differently than I, and that is perfectly okay. At this point, I typically add CMI. Mavacamten's the only one that, you know, we can prescribe commercially at this point. So I'm only adding it as an adjunct therapy to beta blocker or calcium channel blocker, and really for several reasons. I especially do that kind of strategy for someone who has generally lower gradients, though still obstructive, because I find that implementing kind of best hydration practices and discontinuing medications that could be exacerbating the situation along with implementing a beta blocker or a calcium channel blocker really may be sufficient to get that situation under control. And we have a lot of experience with these interventions, so I know all the risks here. And I can very easily play with the doses of beta blockers and calcium channel blockers, like even titrations week by week, which we typically will do. And I don't have that kind of flexibility with cardiac myosin inhibitors right now. Going this route at this point is really helping to reduce the burden of monitoring of cardiac myosin inhibitors for both the patient and, to be honest, for me and my staff. Don't we have to monitor beta blockers and calcium channel blockers too, you might ask? And yes, that's absolutely true. We always initiate the medications and have patients keep a daily log of blood pressure, heart rate. We follow up with them 1 to 2 weeks later and gather that data. But that's all stuff that patients can do at home. You know, it'll take 10 minutes in a day to do something like that, to sit quietly for 5 minutes and check your blood pressure, that kind of thing. It doesn't require taking a half day off of work to go drive somewhere, have an echo, you know, have a clinic visit, that kind of thing. So the monitoring for cardiac myosin inhibitors is burdensome. It's important. It needs to be done, but it's more burdensome than monitoring for calcium channel blockers or beta blockers. Probably the only time at this point that I'm going straight to cardiac myosin inhibitors is in someone who's very symptomatic and has very high resting gradients, you know, gradients that are 60, 70, 80 plus at rest, where I already know from my own experience, I'm unlikely to get the situation under control with these other types of measures. And so, again, I would actually initiate a beta blocker in this situation because it's going to be faster acting than the mavacamten would be. It's going to take several weeks for the mavacamten to really build and for us to see the true effect. So I would probably do them in conjunction.
Wow, these are all amazing answers. And I think so important for our clinical practice because we see these patients often, and some, especially the younger patients who may have sort of be more dependent on the chronotropic sort of capabilities and making sure that who may be more sensitive to the beta blockers or the calcium channel blockers. So maybe in the future, CMIs may be the first line therapy. But as you mentioned, there are certain things which we have to continue on monitoring. And these things, as you said, take time for patients to come out, get echoes, and for the staff too. So through the REMS site process. So I completely agree with you. I think this is something that will potentially become more of a first-line therapy in the future, but yet we have to see it and we have to learn more about it. So when you decide to add a cardiac myosin inhibitor, which therapies do you tend to decrease first? For if the patient's already on beta blockers, if they're on calcium channel blockers, how do you, or does, they are already on disopyramide, for example, how do you go about it and what do you sort of tackle first?
So I always reduce the dose of a calcium channel blocker, whether it's verapamil or diltiazem, down to 120 or 180 milligrams a day, just depending on how high the dose was to begin with. When I initiate the mavacamten, that kind of double negative inotropy could get us into trouble. And so and honestly, we're required to do so by the REMS. So I follow that guidance. I have so few patients on disopyramide, honestly, that I honestly think that cardiac myosin inhibitors will replace disopyramide for the vast majority of my patients, and already really has. The other thing that I make sure is that I actually pay attention to what are the acid reducing medications that patients are, because basically all of them except pantoprazole can interact with mavacamten, and so I switch those and warn patients about it. And then I make sure that they're not on a medication like gemfibrozil, which I rarely use in my practice anyway, and or fluoxetine, kind of strong CYP2C19 inhibitors that can also cause problems. So I deal with those things up front. And then once I have someone on a stable dose of mavacamten and gradients really are under 30, then I actually start to reduce the dose of beta blockers and or discontinue the calcium channel blocker and see what happens with symptoms and gradients over the next couple of months. And sometimes it works and we're able to just have somebody on, you know, just the mavacamten with a very low dose of an AV nodal blocking agent, and sometimes we have to re-implement. And I would say in my experience, it's not necessarily that I'm re-implementing the beta blocker or the calcium channel blocker because of outflow obstruction. It's more related to palpitations and kind of a sense of that patients experience more relief from with the AV nodal blockade.
Wow. So these are very excellent points. Thank you for sharing these great insights. As we all see these patients and we are faced with adjustment of these medications in our daily practices. So it's very important to think about, as you said, as a patient as a whole, as these patients have other comorbidities. And some patients, even though their gradients get better, they still may be symptomatic. So there may be other things which are going on in the background. What are your thoughts on using cardiac myosin inhibitors as disease-modifying agents in the preclinical or the early stage disease of the disease?
I think that's an area that's really exciting and probably holds a lot of promise. You know, we already have some, though limited, data from cardiac MR assessments of patients who've been receiving mavacamten. That's so far what has been published. That shows that there is a significant reduction in the LV mass, in wall thickness, and left atrial size without a concomitant increase in the burden of fibrosis, whether that's interstitial or replacement fibrosis. So, you can imagine a state where perhaps very low doses of cardiac myosin inhibitors would prevent progression or even delay the actual clinical presentation of disease. But I think I wouldn't feel comfortable using the medication off label for someone who's like genotype positive, phenotype negative, you know, to try to prevent clinical development of disease at this point. I would definitely want some data. And that's going to be a long time in coming, I think. I don't think we're going to get that data in the next couple of years.
Yeah, as you said, it's work in progress, but it's an exciting time for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy patients. So that leads me to my next question. When can we expect cardiac myosin inhibitors to be included in our ACC/AHA hypertrophic cardiomyopathy guidelines? When should we expect our next update?
So, you know, the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology really are moving towards a living guidelines document type of situation where as new data is coming in there, it's being assessed in terms of robustness and validity and assessing whether or not there's enough there to actually warrant a change or an update to the guidelines. And so HCM guidelines have actually been identified as the kind of first or kind of to go through this process. So I imagine that we're going to see a guideline update in the next year. And for sure, cardiac myosin inhibitors will be addressed in it. There's enough data at this point, several different trials to be able to look at and have at least some, you know, statements in the guidelines about what seems to make the most sense. Now, you know, this area is very fast moving. So even when there's an update and even when there's going to be like a living document, so to say, it still will be at least a year, if not longer, behind like current actual state, you know, but I actually think we'll see it very in this next year.
Very exciting. Very okay. We're looking forward to the new updated guidelines as the new trials are coming out, as we're seeing more data coming out as well. So my other question is for you is, cardiac myosin inhibitors, are they the medical myectomy that we have been waiting for? Could you tell us more about how you approach your patients in clinic or how you discuss this with them in regards to shared decision-making in regards to introducing cardiac myosin inhibitors versus referring these patients who are refractory on this first-line therapies to septal reduction therapies? Could you tell us more about this and sort of how you approach these things?
So, you know, at this point, there's no head-to-head data that would compare outcomes with treatment of cardiac myosin inhibitor versus septal reduction therapies. And I'm not sure that we're going to actually have this kind of data, like a randomized clinical trial of a cardiac myosin inhibitor, you know, versus myectomy or alcohol septal ablation that would look at short and long-term outcomes. I'm not sure that we're going to see such a randomized clinical trial. So I think we have to look at what data is out there and compare. So in the positive bucket for cardiac myosin inhibitors, and like specifically right now for mavacamten, since it's what's on the pharmacy shelf, is that compared with surgical myectomy and alcohol septal ablation, first, there's no hospital stay. There's no cracking of the chest, no being put on bypass, risking death, infection, stroke, renal failure, bleeding complications, a procedural complication like a VSD or a pacemaker implant. Those risks don't really exist with mavacamten. Mind you, generally speaking, in the hands of an experienced surgeon or proceduralist who chooses the right patients to undergo these procedures, is technically skilled in the procedure and in post-procedural care, these risks are really generally very low. But we know that the risk of these bad outcomes becomes much higher with low-volume proceduralists who are often practicing at low-volume hospitals where the expertise that high-volume proceduralists and hospitals doesn't exist. And so we know that, like from work that's done such by like Dr. Luke Kim, looking at the U.S. nationwide inpatient database that was published back in 2016. In terms of the efficacy in reducing outflow gradients, so for example, if we look at Nix Madeira's Cleveland Clinic data that was published in 2019 on roughly 1,500 patients that underwent surgical myectomy plus minus a mitral valve surgery or another procedure, post-op echoes were typically done in the immediate post-hospital kind of time period or intra-hospital time period, but some were done as late as 1 year after the surgery. And What their team reported was resting gradients around 15 millimeters of mercury post-procedure, down from about 63 millimeters of mercury pre-procedure, and mean provocable Valsalva and post-exercise gradients around 17 millimeters of mercury, down from about 90 to 120 millimeters of mercury, respectively. Then we can look at data from meta-analyses that look at surgical myectomy versus alcohol septal ablation in terms of management of obstructive HCM. And for example, Dr. Singh's assessment that was published in 2015, he looked at 805 patients who underwent alcohol septal ablation, and mean gradients went from about 78 at baseline to 20 post-procedure. And with about 1,000 patients who underwent surgical myectomy, mean gradients went from 81 down to 12. So now if we turn our attention to the cardiac myosin inhibitors in terms of outflow tract obstruction efficacy, Explorer showed that with 30 weeks of treatment, so just about 6 months, mean resting gradients among 117 recipients of the drug was 15 millimeters of mercury, down from pretreatment gradient of about 51. So I will point out that the resting gradients in the patients that were in the Explorer trial were generally lower than resting gradients for patients that have been assessed in the surgical and procedural cohorts. Mean provocable gradients in the Explorer participants were a little bit higher after treatment. They were about 25 millimeters of mercury with Valsalva, 38 millimeters of mercury post-exercise. I mean, these are still down from gradients in the 70s and 80s before they received treatment, but it's a little bit higher than post-surgical and post-alcohol septal ablation values that we have seen. We can also look at the analysis of like a median of 62 weeks of treatment in the MAVA LTE study that was published actually last month and showed mean resting gradients about 11 millimeters of mercury, down from 48 to begin with that amount of that length of time of treatment with mavacamten, Valsalva gradients down from about 70 to 22. And then we can also look at Redwood data from cohorts 1 and 2. Now, it's only 28 participants, so it's a small number. And they were treated for a short period of time, 10 weeks. But most of the patients in the alcohol septal ablation and myectomy cohorts were assessed, you know, in the index hospital stay. And so 10 weeks of treatment and then like an echo at that time, that's not that far out of the realm of what we're seeing in terms of like treatment time and outcome assessment time. And with Redwood, gradients went down to 13 at rest and down to about 35 with Valsalva. And I think, I know that the 48-week treatment results with aficamten will be presented at ACC. So we'll see kind of longer-term data from that too. So I think kind of like the upshot of all of that is that there is significant reduction in outflow obstruction with all of these modes of therapy. And at least the limited data that we have suggests that maybe septal reduction therapy reduces it a bit more. But I would argue, like, is that clinically relevant? Is there a clinically relevant difference between a gradient of, you know, in the 30s post-Valsalva as opposed to a gradient in the teens post-Valsalva? And the answer is probably not. I think the risk that is hardest to compare based on the available data is the outcome of LV systolic dysfunction as a consequence of either septal reduction therapy or cardiac myosin inhibitor. And there's a lot of discussion around this particular complication as it relates to cardiac myosin inhibitors, but there's actually not a lot of discussion about this as it relates to septal reduction therapy. And post-procedural outcomes papers don't really look at LVEF reliably. Like when you look at all these manuscripts, they talk about, you know, pacemaker implant, death, this, that, the other, but rarely is there an assessment of the LVEF post-procedure. And I think part of it is because there's just kind of an assumption that it's fine. But there is one assessment that looked at LVEF post-procedurally, and that was an analysis of the SHARE registry, the sarcomeric human cardiomyopathy registry. that looked at about 7,000 patients and looked at the incidence of LV systolic dysfunction over time. This was published in 2020. And there was a higher prevalence of history of septal reduction therapy among those with LV systolic dysfunction. So of about 1,200 patients that underwent a septal reduction therapy procedure, 11% developed incidence LV systolic dysfunction, which we define as an EF less than 50%, at a median of 6 years after the procedure. The hazard ratio was 2.6. The potential reasons for that you can think would be intraventricular conduction delay or dyssynchrony that occurs from the bundle branch block, and perhaps a degree of more severe underlying adverse remodeling due to higher gradients that initially even led to the septal reduction therapy, but we don't know that for sure. If we look at the cardiac myosin inhibitor data, the published MAVA LTE data reported 12 instances or 5.2% of patients treated with mavacamten experienced an LVEF less than 50% with that median 62 weeks of treatment. We can look at the 56-week Valor HCM data that was published last August, and that showed 12 of 108 or 11% of patients experienced an LVEF less than 50%. And then in the Redwood cohorts 1 and 2, there were 28 patients that participated that received aficamten, and two of those 28 experienced an LVEF less than 50%, which is 7%. But I would take that percentage with a bit of a grain of salt because they're such small numbers. The data that had been shared from the FOREST HCM open label treatment with aficamten study was shared by Dr. Mastry at ESC Heart Failure Society meeting in 2022. And showed no instances of drug-related LVEF less than 50% that could be attributed to aficamten amongst just 38 patients at that point. So there was one instance of LVEF less than 50%, but it was in the setting of significant alcohol consumption and AFib, and the investigators felt that that was more likely the reason for the LV dysfunction and not related to aficamten. So I guess I would say all of this data, you know, makes me think hard about, you know, what's right for patients. And I just talk about all of it when we're talking about, you know, these are your symptoms and we're not really getting anywhere with your current beta blocker or calcium channel blocker. And here are your options. And here's what we know about your options. Then I talk about myosin inhibitors and septal reduction therapies. And we have really candid conversations about, A, what's our experience here at our center for all of these? Because my experience, you know, with alcohol septal ablation is going to be different than, for example, Dr. Naidu's experience out in New York, because his practice is alcohol septal ablation and mine is not. And so our outcomes are going to be different. Our outcomes are going to be different with myectomy. My outcomes with a cardiac myosin inhibitor are going to be different than someone who, you know, who only has 10 patients on it. And so we talk about what are our centers' experiences with each of these, and really put the ball in the patient's court. Like, this is what we know, and here are your choices. And we really make that decision together based on pros and cons and really how the patient, the individual, feels about, you know, each of those things. And a lot of things that go into it are things that you and I would think about too, you know, like really weighing, you know, being on a medication for potentially the rest of my life, like mavacamten, the rest of my life, and having to have an echo every 3 months, potentially for the rest of my life. And that if something happens and I need to come off of this medication, there's a real risk that I'm going to go back to exactly the way that things were before I started the medication. Now, we don't know that in terms of long-term data. We know that from, you know, 6 months of treatment with mavacamten, but we don't know that with 5 years of treatment with mavacamten, you know, versus like the real risks of like needing a pacemaker after surgery or even having my chest cracked open, you know, so people are going to feel differently about those things. I might be okay with having my chest cracked open and being like, well, then I might be okay for 10 years or longer, or, you know, maybe the success rate will be really great. And other people will be like, no, thank you.
You've made amazing, excellent points, Sarah, all throughout. It's so important to individualize therapy to a patient. it's so important to consider that therapy alongside all of the established medical therapies that we have, but also the interventional therapies, and have that conversation with a patient in your clinic and present the data, as you said, which may be different for each site depending on what we have available. So amazing points, I think, for our physicians as well, for patients. It's important to have that conversation together with your doctor.
Else, Patricia, that I think we don't necessarily talk about, and I've seen this happen and patients have told me, is like, you know, they underwent a myectomy and now I'm seeing them for the first time and they're like, I don't feel better, you know, or they underwent an alcohol septal ablation and they're like, I don't feel better. I thought I was going to feel a lot better. Or they have a recurrence of obstruction years down the road and they're like, wait, what are you talking about? And I think it's important to have realistic conversations about those expectations too, that nothing is perfect and everything has a consequence, you know, and it's unfair to build up a septal reduction therapy as a one and done. If you have this procedure, you're going to feel great and you're going to do great and that's it. We're done with it. We know HCM is a chronic disease. Like there's, you know, you're getting rid of like a little chunk of muscle or physically getting rid of some obstruction with the alcohol septal ablation. Well, what about the rest of the heart that's left and still has dysfunctional myocardium? And so really having very realistic conversations about these are chronic diseases and these are treatments that we can offer right now, but all of them mean that we're going to know each other for the rest of your life and that none of this means that you're not going to, you know, having a surgery doesn't mean you're not going to be on medication for the rest of your life. It very well could mean that you still need medication the rest of your life, you know?
That is so true. I could not agree with you more. I think we see patients and we see how their symptoms change. They may not necessarily correlate completely to the gradients that we're seeing on the echocardiogram. So really individualistic approach is a key, and having that open, as you said, candid conversation is crucial with each one of our patients in regards to initiating cardiac myosin inhibitors, but also in regards to other therapies which may be potentially out there. Amazing, amazing point, Sarah. So thank you for sharing them with us. My other question for you is, we see, obviously, there may be sex differences in regards to cardiac myosin inhibitor therapy. What do we know about that in regards to women versus men? As you know, the data has been recently published and you are part of it. So this is our question.
Yeah, Sharon Cressy really led the charge and with the post hoc analysis of the Explorer data, looking at the effect of aficamten in women compared with men, and found what we already know, which is that women are older at the time of treatment, they're more symptomatic, they have worse health status, they have more, you know, congestive heart failure, kind of as assessed by NT-proBNP at least. Their NT-proBNP levels were significantly higher than men who were participating in the trial at baseline, and they had lower peak VO2s than men did. And the effect of aficamten on reducing gradients and improving peak VO2 was the same in men and women, highly effective and equally effective. But the improvements in KCCQ, so personal kind of assessments of health status, and improvements in NT-proBNP, which is very objective, were much more dramatic in men than in women. So it really is interesting to think about mavacamten and cardiac myosin inhibitors, because you kind of assume you're going to see similar things with aficamten, though we don't have that kind of data yet. But it would be interesting to think about, can these medications and implementing them earlier in the disease process really prevent, especially women who have worse outcomes overall, from experiencing that kind of disease process?
Fantastic. No, I think it's something that we definitely have to learn more about and we have to investigate more, but these are very important points. For the future, what should we expect from the future trials? What is in sort of in our near future what should we be looking out for?
Yeah, so much. There's so much in the pipeline. So the phase 3 aficamten versus placebo in the treatment of obstructive HCM Sequoia trial, will be published soon. So we'll have that kind of larger data on aficamten to be able to look at. The MAPLE-HCM trial is underway, which is beta blocker versus aficamten in the treatment of obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So that will answer some important questions about whether or not cardiac myosin inhibitors and aficamten in particular can be a first-line therapy for patients with symptomatic obstructive HCM. The ODYSSEY trial, which is mavacamten versus placebo in patients with non-obstructive HCM, very sadly on our end, but I think excitedly for everybody else around, closed to screening yesterday. So we will have data about that therapy for patients with non-obstructive HCM in the next year, for sure. And then the ACACIA trial of aficamten versus placebo in non-obstructive HCM patients is getting underway as well. So there's a lot of investigations of these medications in different kind of populations of patients with HCM. Both are starting trials in pediatric age patients, which is huge. So there's just so much there to look forward to.
Can't wait. Can't wait what the next few years will bring and what we'll learn from all the investigations that are going on with the cardiac myosin inhibitors. It's certainly a very exciting time for both the physicians who are treating patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy as well for the patients. And as you know, some of us say, it's actually a good time to sort of address this disease and as there are many more options at this point. What are some of the take-home points that you have for our listeners as we're nearing the end of our podcast? What would you like to share with them to take home with them?
I think mainly that the future is so bright. You know, we certainly have a lot to learn, but we have come a long way as we started out kind of talking about how is it that you and I are even sitting here having this conversation? I mean, it's really taken decades of scientific investigation, perseverance, and curiosity to get to this point. We have some really important new therapies that are on pharmacy shelves now and in the pipeline, and not just CMIs, you know. And so we're looking forward to other pharmacotherapies, gene therapies that are also in the pipeline. And all of this means that we have choices where there weren't very many choices before. So while it's stressful trying to figure out what's best for whom and admitting that we may not actually know that right now because we need more experience to figure that out, but it's better than having no choices at all.
Agree. The choices are amazing. And I, as you said, future is bright. There's so much to look forward to. And you have really, truly given us an amazing insight into the cardiac myosin inhibitor, into the beginnings of it, the stages, the progression, how we got here to this point where we have it, where we have them available. And I just can't wait to see what the future will bring and how much more we'll be able to offer to our patients. So thank you, Sarah. It was truly an honor and a pleasure, privilege to speak with you and to learn from you today. And thank you for listening to us. And thank you for listening to the podcast. And please make sure to tune in for the other episodes as we will be producing them.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for spending this time with me. I really appreciate it too.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Pleasure was ours.
Yeah, take care.
That was Dr. Patrizia Galazka and Dr. Sarah Saberi. To learn more about the HCM Society, please visit hcmsociety.org. This episode was edited and produced by Earfluence. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon on In the Thick of It.